From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. President Biden had three words today for Republicans, intent on suing over his new vaccine mandate that would cover two-thirds of American workers.
Have at it.
And they probably will. Republican critics are calling the new rules, which require businesses with over 100 workers to vaccinate or test their employees weekly, unconstitutional and presidential overreach. Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts told Fox News he's looking at ways to push back.
Just as this announcement came out, the phones in my office were ringing off the hook with people who are just in shock about this. And business owners are calling me, telling me about how this is going to make it so hard for them to be able to run their businesses. The amount of
All right, let's bring in our political roundtable. Eugene Daniels is White House correspondent and Playbook co-author for Politico. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great. And Chad Pergram, congressional correspondent for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eugene, if I can start with you, the president isn't just getting heat from conservatives, which we will talk about. Some public health experts say that he actually should have done more, such as requiring vaccines for airplane passengers. Was the president trying to thread the political needle here, you think?
No, absolutely. And I think something that's really interesting is we've been talking to health experts for months who've been wanting something like this for months from the Biden administration, and they've held off. They have held off. They've said they, you know, at times they didn't feel like they had the legal justification for or the legal power to do so. I also think that politically, it's one of those things that just wasn't going to be very popular, and the backlash was going to be swift. But it's very clear that the administration's got to a point, as the president said yesterday, is that their patience is just running thin with people who are unvaccinated. And so all of the things that he outlined yesterday are set to make it's harder to live life and operate in society in America if you're unvaccinated. And I think it is the stick of the carrot and stick that we haven't seen so much this year.
Yeah. Yeah, well, our patience is running thin. I mean, that part sounded like a lecture a little bit. Chad, the president surely knew he would get blowback over this from the right. He says he's willing to take controversial positions. How big a stand is this, or a risk is this, politically, you think, for the president?
Well, it's kind of something that the president had to do. He realizes that his presidency, hinges on the success or failure of dealing with this pandemic and vis-a-vis the economy. That's why some people said, you know, look, OSHA is there to make it a safe workplace. We were kind of surprised that he didn't get them more involved long ago. So that's one thing. And the political blowback is natural on Capitol Hill, you know, especially from Republicans. You know, they're for small government. They're not going to like much of anything the president does to start with. But especially when it gets into this issue of government mandating things. And I want to come back to a term that we used to talk a lot about in the 1990s, unfunded mandates. And when you played the piece of sound a minute ago, that's what people are talking about, that you're making a business do something. The argument, of course, could be made that maybe you're going to make that business more successful because they'll have healthy employees and more people will be willing to come in and, you know, conduct commerce and so on and so forth. But anytime Republicans can portray Democrats as big government mandates, masks, vaccine mandates, anything like that, they believe that is good politics with their base.
Well, let's listen to something that the president said last night.
This is not about freedom or personal choice. It's about protecting yourself and those around you.
Ohio Republican and Senate candidate J.D. Vance isn't buying that. It's what we're talking about now. He's calling for mass civil disobedience, urging workers not to comply with the vaccine mandate. Eugene, are Republicans managing to convert vaccine supporters into anti-vaccine mandate voters?
I don't think so. I don't. At this rate and at this time in this pandemic, it seems like we've kind of all gotten to our corners, right? When it comes to, you know, the 25% of Americans who haven't even gotten one shot yet, that is a group that is going to be difficult to convince to get that vaccine. And that doesn't mean that they're all Republicans, right? These are also some. I have some in my in my family, a Black family in South Carolina, who have not gotten vaccinated. So there are different pockets of it all over the country. But what we know is that this is people are very much have their minds made up about this. And that's why the administration is hoping that the private industry, what they did and announced yesterday, is going to force people to want to get vaccinated because they're going to have, you know, they don't want to get fired, for example, or they don't want to continue to always have to go get tests and prove that they don't have COVID-19. So that aspect of it, the political aspect of it, how people feel about it are pretty much set.
Right. We're hearing from business groups like the Business Roundtable and the National Association of Manufacturers welcoming these new rules. But what are some of the unanswered questions about the new rules today, Chad? What are some things that you're thinking about and some of the legal battles that might be out there?
Something that some people here on Capitol Hill flagged for me, they said, this doesn't apply to members of Congress nor their staffs. You know, Congress is exempt from a lot of these things. They often follow direction of OSHA or direction from the Office of Personnel Management, which deals with federal employees. But they don't have to. You know, they're kind of exempt through this through Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution, which says Congress can make their own rules. And really, on Capitol Hill, you have 535 different separate HR offices. Each office kind of sets their own rules here. The other thing that I thought was interesting in the comments from Republicans, they have not been critical of when you've had other people, say basically the same thing the president said yesterday. The governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice, the Republican governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey, they have not attacked those figures when they've said, look, guys, get vaccinated. It works. You guys are causing problems for us, those who aren't vaccinated. And when President Biden does it, you have this sense in the Republican Party where they view him as being a scold, and they don't think that that works well. And there's frankly some Democrats who don't think that works well for the president.
And I also think just to add to that, part of this is that the Republican Party, when it comes to how, they basically have been saying these things about President Biden anyway, right? What we saw a lot and was trending online was that he was a tyrant. He's forcing you to do things that you don't want to do. He doesn't care about freedom. That is things the Republican parties have already been saying. And so folks that I've been talking to, Democrats, say, well, for the safety of America, for the public health, they're already calling us this. So who cares about the blowback from the Republican Party on that aspect? They were calling you a tyrant, the day before you rolled out this plan.
All right, let's move to the issue of abortion here. Chad, there's another big fight that the White House has joined this week. The Justice Department is suing the state of Texas over its toughest in the nation ban on abortions. This, as we know, is an issue that brings out people like perhaps no other issue in policy and politics. How do you expect this to play out politically here?
Well, Democrats, obviously, they don't like the decision. They didn't like what happened at the Supreme Court. Justice Breyer, has indicated in a couple of different interviews saying that, and I can't remember exactly how many varies he said, but it was a very, 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 very wrong decision on the Texas case. And this could, in fact, prove to be a test case that they get later. But what's important, you're absolutely right, Eugene. It starts to get people to the polls on both sides. And Democrats are willing to say, hey, can we, appropriate this to get more people there? Say, look, they're going to, ban abortions in all these places. We're going to try legislation to codify Roe versus Wade into law. Those on the left are using that as another reason to get rid of the filibuster, because there's no way you can make Roe versus Wade into law getting past a 60-vote threshold in the Senate. That's a problem there. So that issue has now arisen. Never mind that you have some pro-life Democrats, who probably, might support the Texas decision or, might not support whatever the Democrats are trying to come out to codify Roe versus Wade. So you're seeing this energy on the Democratic side, certainly to use this as a wedge issue. And especially when you look at, a place like Texas, where, there's been, some trending there more in the Democratic direction. There's some wondering whether or not this will ultimately backfire on the Republican Party, just not in Texas, but elsewhere.
Now, Eugene, Republican Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, I want to ask you about his political capital right now. This week, he came under fire for defending this law, which does not allow for abortions in the case of incest or rape. Let's take a quick listen.
Texas will work tirelessly to make sure that we eliminate all rapists from the streets of Texas by aggressively going out and arresting them and prosecuting them and getting them off the streets.
Eugene, he drew criticism for that remark. How do you think it's going to play?
Yeah, I think the criticism is that it is, you know, you can't, that's just, it's not true, right? The idea that you're going to get rid of all the rapists off the streets is something that we, if that could happen, it would already have been done in Texas and in any state in this country, in every territory, and also on the planet. And so I think that aspect of it has made it a little bit difficult for him. But, you know, almost the same with COVID. When it comes to Greg Abbott, his political capital lies in the Republican Party. And so if Democrats have an issue with things that he says, things that he does, it almost doesn't matter. And I think that is a part of how our politics works nowadays, that it almost doesn't matter what the other party thinks about you, because both parties have such don't have a lot of room in the party for disagreement, especially on the Republican side of things.
Tomorrow is 9/11, the 20th anniversary. President Biden will visit all three sites where the planes crashed, and former President Trump will commemorate a boxing match. There is a lot to watch for tomorrow. Eugene Daniels is White House correspondent and Playbook co-author for Politico, and Chad Pergram is a congressional correspondent for Fox News. We didn't have enough time, but thank you both so much for taking the time.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
Residents of Louisiana are still reeling from Hurricane Ida, more than a week after the Category 4 hurricane struck. And that includes 15 Native American tribes in the state. The United Uma Nation is one of them. With a population of 19,000, Uma tribal citizens are spread over six parishes south of New Orleans. Monique Verdan is a citizen of the Uma Nation, and she's a member of a group working for social justice, economic justice, and environmental justice. It's called Another Gulf is Possible. And Monique, I understand you yourself had to evacuate last week. So where are you and what's your situation?
Well, I'm back in Bulbuncha, which is also better known as the city of New Orleans. My family land, which is my primary home in St. Bernard Parish, was fine. My studio in the city where I stay quite a bit had the ceiling fall. So I'm kind of camped out at a friend's house right now where I have Wi-Fi and trying to organize distribution drop-offs for the Bayou communities at the ends of the roads in Terrebonne and Lafourche parishes.
And tell me a little bit more about the damage you saw that Ida brought to homes, to neighborhoods.
The eye of the storm just rolled up into the Barataria Terrebonne estuary, which, you know, South Louisiana is losing land at one of the fastest rates in the world. And that territory, which is the traditional homes of the indigenous peoples, are found between the Atchafalaya and Mississippi rivers. That is where the majority of the indigenous population still is at the ends of these bayous. But the winds just blew communities to bits. As my little cousin told me when she went home to Pointe-aux-Chenes, she was like, Monique, I can tell you who has a home left better than I can tell you who doesn't.
Wow. And as you're describing, this storm comes on top of a situation where you're losing land, more rapidly than I understand almost anywhere else in North America here. So, I mean, how do these interact here? Does that just mean there is far less buffer when the storm surge comes?
Yeah. However many miles of marsh we have, that can cut down the storm surge by feet in some cases. But because our marshes have been decimated, and that being tied to a legacy of extraction and also a legacy of manipulating, you know, the nature's intelligence down here by constricting the Mississippi River and, you know, kind of cutting off our lifeline of fresh water and sediments getting into our wetlands. But then also since the 1930s, we've had over 10,000 miles of canals that have been cut through our marshes, and not to mention just pulling materials out of the wetlands and how that also contributes to marsh collapse.
Yeah. Wow. And as you're describing, right, water coming from all these directions for all these different reasons, there's that water and then there's the freshwater situation. Is that available right now?
No, I was just talking to an elder in Dewlarge, which is a bayou community. An elder was saying, you know, they were collecting rainwater in their buckets just for basic things like flushing toilets. And we were talking about how important it is, you know, to have cisterns that can be weather resistant, and how important that infrastructure is in this moment of needing, you know, to really recognize this. We have to adapt to these changing weather and extreme weather events.
Yeah. And in the middle of all of this, you're living in a place where there's so much petrochemical activity, right? Pipelines and chemical plants and historic toxic waste dumps and sites. Is this a situation where a fear or perhaps a reality of oil spills coming?
Oh, I mean, the oils spill all the time. You know, refineries have been flaring for days here, and I was.
You mean kind of flaring the hydrocarbons through the smokestacks?
Right, because everyone lost power, including the refineries, and when that happens, then they have to manage. You have to remember that, you know, before we had oil and gas in South Louisiana, we had sugarcane. So we are still operating very much so off of a kind of plantation mentality.
And while I guess with all this resource and corporate wealth, we're learning from Ida, not just in Louisiana, but in other places, that so often the people who are hit the worst are the least well off.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we have to recognize that we're all connected. If we're burning fossil fuels here in South Louisiana, those impacts are felt far beyond South Louisiana. You know, man definitely has a role that we've been playing and that we've inherited, you know, but we have to be honest about how we got here in order for us to find a way forward.
We have been speaking with Monique Verdan. She's a citizen of the Uma Nation in Louisiana, and she's also part of a group called Another Gulf is Possible, seeking environmental, social, and economic justice. Monique, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much.
We are living in a golden age of influencers, when it seems like every day a new person emerges from obscurity to become a social media sensation. And it's not just teenagers and 20-somethings who are getting famous online. Let's bring in Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. She helps us analyze culture and conversations on social media. Welcome back, Femi.
Thank you very much, Tanya.
Yeah, well, first of all, in case folks haven't noticed, older people are becoming TikTok stars too. My kids love to show me these kinds of videos. Grandfluencers, right? Who are they?
Yeah, well, they don't necessarily have to be grandparents, but they're in a certain age bracket. Let me give you a couple of examples. Have a look out for Irvin Randall on Instagram. He says in his profile, too grown. He is an educator, a model, extremely pleasing, some people may well say, when they look at him. He's stylish. He's extraordinary. He looks like the young influencers, but obviously he's of a certain age. There's Baddy Winkle, who I love. She's on Instagram, 3.5 million followers. Her tagline is "Stealing your man since 1928." She is outrageous. She's wearing a onesie. She's wearing a feather boa. Her hair is different colors. They are embracing the fun of social media. And the reason why that we're looking at some of these extraordinary older social posters is because most people who post on social media are under 35 years old. So they're breaking that mold, breaking that trend.
Yeah. I mean, let's hear from one of them, a group called the Old Gays. Here they are on TikTok after finding out that the pop star Rihanna is following them.
Why would such a beautiful, talented woman of Rihanna be watching us?
Because we're entertaining, aren't we, Rihanna?
Or maybe it's because she thinks of us. I'm looking at this. So old.
All right, I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the Old Gays, I'm going to tell you. So you know, what is it that's drawing people to these older...
They're California friends. I don't want to just call them the Old Gays because they're also great individual personalities. Go on then, Tanya. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just referring to how they were referring to themselves. But what is it that's drawing people to older influencers now? Is it something about this moment we're in? Or is it just that, I mean, we're part of the world too?
Exactly that. And also, as you heard in that little Instagram clip where Rihanna loved the old gays, which is their Insta handle as well, is that they're fun. They have a twinkle. They have confidence. They're smashing taboos. They're also too old to worry what people think about them. So they have that special secret sauce that you really need to be a successful social media influencer, is that you just say what you think, you say what's on your mind, you don't mind if you're being outrageous, and they're really too old to care. It doesn't really matter.
On the other side of this, right, on the other side of the spectrum, there was a controversy recently between the parents of 14-year-old YouTuber Piper Rockville and star Pink. What happened here?
So a little while ago, Pink posted this tweet. How many kids like Piper Raquel are being exploited by their parents? And at what point do the rest of us say, this isn't okay for a 13-year-old to be posing in a bikini whilst her mother takes the photo? Question mark, exclamation mark, question mark, exclamation mark. It got a huge conversation started. If you don't know Piper Raquel, she's a young influencer. She sings, she makes videos. She's got a huge YouTube account, over 8 million people. And now she's 14 years old and she's hugely, hugely successful. So Pink was not calling out Piper. She's a minor. Pink was calling out a parent for allowing her minor to post some provocative pictures.
You know what's interesting about this? Yeah, Femi, is that, I mean, since the beginning of time in the entertainment industry, we've seen kids become stars. Shirley Temple, Drew Barrymore, Britney Spears, that's just a few of them. Yeah. How young is really too young?
Well, it's that what are you wearing argument that every teen is very familiar with. Right. But how young is too young? It's technically for social media about 13 years old. Most social media platforms do not let minors post unless they have parents' permission. And then it's a case of what are they doing on social? And what Piper has done, and she started posting from when I think she's about 9, is that she's growing up in front of us. So she's experimenting with clothing, she's pouting, she's looking sexy for her friends. And that is the issue. It's like, are we ready to see youngsters grow into adults in front of us? And what are the repercussions if people who don't have good intent are watching that blossoming?
That was Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. As the World Trade Center towers fell 20 years ago, smaller, more personal crises were also playing out all over the country, including one about an organ donation between two children's hospitals, one in Nashville, the other in Houston, that was put in doubt when the entire country's airspace was closed to traffic. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer tells us what happened.
The world stood still to watch iconic towers collapsing on live TV and unthinkable carnage inside.
That is about as frightening a scene as you will ever see.
At the same time, in Nashville, a somber surgery was underway at Vanderbilt Children's Hospital to retrieve the liver of a baby organ donor. Jill Grandis still leads Tennessee Donor Services, which coordinates transplants in the region.
The staff person that was at the hospital, standing in the operating room, he called me and he said, what are we going to do? No planes are allowed to leave the ground.
That baby's liver was supposed to be placed in a cooler and hitch a ride on a charter plane to Houston, and the clock was ticking. So Grandis says her only thought was to call air traffic control.
And believe it or not, 20 years ago in the Blue Pages, there was a listing for the tower.
To her surprise, someone picked up. Eventually, she talked to a supervisor who made her own calls. Tennessee Senator Bill Frist, a transplant surgeon before entering politics, intervened. On the other end, Dr. John Goss was awaiting the precious cargo.
I don't know that it could have happened anywhere else because they had this firsthand relationship with Bill Frist because of his, his time as a physician.
With no commercial traffic in the sky and fighter jets protecting the borders and urban centers, the Tennessee Air Guard was cleared to fly. They revved up a C-130 cargo plane, big enough to transport a tank or a presidential limousine. to airlift a 10-ounce liver to Texas Children's Hospital. John Howard was one of the co-pilots.
We usually take some pretty interesting things in the back of a C-130, and that was probably the lightest payload next to being empty that I've ever flown in my life.
And it was a quiet ride. Howard says the crew was silent for the first half. There was real concern they could be shot out of the sky. They dropped the liver in Houston without even shutting down the engines. The transplant went smoothly, and baby Karina is now 20 years old and in college.
I was there, but I don't remember it.
We agreed not to use Karina's last name to protect her privacy. She says she seems to learn more of her own story with each 9/11 anniversary. And over time, her appreciation builds.
All these people who didn't know this little baby, who had no connection to this child, worked together on a day that really tested our nation.
As she transitions into adulthood, she says it's a story that increasingly inspires her to have the same kind of blind commitment to helping others. For Here and Now, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
You may have heard of a Broadway musical based on a real-life 9/11 story. It's called Come From Away. It's a feel-good show that won the Tony Award, perhaps because it strikes the notes of virtue and goodness on a day that those qualities seemed missing from the world. Come From Away takes place in an itty-bitty fishing town 1,000 miles from Lower Manhattan in Newfoundland, home to Celtic heritage and lilting voices.
11:53 a.m.
Tuesday,
September 11, 2001. Any available community buildings will be converted into shelters. With thousands of passengers arriving at any minute, the town is asking for help with, well, anything you can do.
Within minutes of the planes hitting the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, American airspace shut down. So, planes still in the air from Europe had to divert to Canada. And some 7,000 passengers landed in the tiny town of Gander on Newfoundland, scrambling to catch up to the horrific news.
Not to say too much, and that's when rumors start flying. There was an accident.
An accident?
The U.S. airspace is closed.
For the first time in history.
Why won't she tell us what's happened?
The helicopter crashed in Pennsylvania.
The helicopter crashed.
Ma'am, I need to
wait. We need to do something.
It's 1-1-3. Oh, my God. It's 1-1-3.
This musical is the story of these plain people, as they were called, and their hosts in Gander, who on this dark day for humanity showed so much of it. They feed, house, clothe, and pour drinks. They open up their shops, no charge. They fill more than 1,000 prescriptions for free for these folks who are, in the lingo, come from away, hence the title of the show. Two women are central characters. One, Beulah Cooper of Gander, made me chuckle a bit, remembering how September 11th unfolded for her.
I got a phone call asking me to bring a tray of sandwiches to the Legion, and I had no clue what was going on. So I made my sandwiches, and I brought them down, and I asked what was going on. And they said there was a plane load of people coming in, but it was the wee hours in the morning when they came in. And I took some men over to the hotel to make phone calls, and then I took some women to the hotel to make phone calls.
Okay, now here's the stage version of Beulah.
Hello, this is Beulah Davis down at the Academy. I heard we might be getting some guests, and I thought I'd see if I could help who's ever in charge of getting a school organized. How many passengers can we take? Well, we fit about 400 students. Yes, we could probably do 600. Yeah, or sure, 700 if we really pack them in. When are they coming? Could be any time now. Well, I'm glad I phoned.
Beulah forms a close tie with one of the passengers, Hannah O'Rourke of New York. Hannah was traveling back from her native Ireland that day.
It took off, you know, and they said that we were going to land in Newfoundland, Gander, Newfoundland. And everybody was looking at one another, and then they explained that there was problems at the airport and problems in New York. We didn't know what was going to happen or where we were going to go.
Hannah and Beulah were both 60-something at the time, and both mothers of firefighters. From Newfoundland, Hannah frantically phones New York over and over for any news of her son, Kevin. He's a fireman with Rescue Company 2 in Brooklyn, and he's missing.
I am telling you, listen, my son, he takes risks. He's not missing. He's helping or hurt. He'll get out of this. Yes, I'll keep trying. And yes, here's the number. And yes, at the Legion in Gander, I'll be right here. I should be there when it's over and done. When he comes through the door and says, be there for my son, but instead I am here. I am here. She leaves message after message for her son until there's no more room on his answering machine. All I know.
20 years later, the real-life Hannah remembers that frustration of so many calls not getting through. She's now 87.
You took pot shot to, if you got through, you got through, and if you didn't, you didn't. And that was it, but we got through. It was the same, no news, you know, no news yet, you know. We let you know when, you know.
Beulah walks me to church, and when we get there, I light a candle for my son. And I do too.
During Come From Away, in the awfulness of not knowing that so many of us shared that day, Hannah steps into a church with another passenger and recalls a Franciscan prayer.
Make me a channel of your peace.
Make me a channel of your peace.
Where there's despair in life,
where there's despair in life, let me bring
hope. Where there is darkness, only light.
Where there is darkness, only
light. And where there's sadness, ever so.
After 5 days in Gander, the Plain People finally fly home, and Hannah gets the news. Her son Kevin had been killed in the North Tower of the World Trade Center.
We had to wait to come home till we got news. But they kept informing me, no, that he was fine, he'd be fine, you know, Kevin. If there's a way to get out, Kevin will find it, you know. But unfortunately, he didn't, you know. You have to pick up the pieces, you know.
Beulah remembered hearing about it from Hannah.
Very tearful. Very. In fact, I could tear up now just thinking about it. You know, it's hard. It's hard when you lose a child. It's hard. But she knew in her heart of hearts that they weren't going to find him. They were going to find his body.
Come From Away debuted in 2013 in Toronto, and 4 years later began a run on Broadway. In the audience one night were the two moms portrayed on the stage, Beulah of Newfoundland, Hannah of New York.
We had dinner, and then we went to see the show. They had tickets for us to go to the show. And every time we go to the show, they sit two of us together, and we hold hands, and we shed tears together.
I ask Hannah if she enjoys the show, or if it's too much.
And the first time it was, you know. I say the first time it was very hard to watch, you know, because you were going through the motions again, you know. And I said the musical keeps his memory alive, you know. All he wanted to do was to be a fireman, to help people and save lives, and that's what he wanted to do. That was his passion.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
Tonight in Washington, D.C., the Broadway cast of Come From Away will give a free performance on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Happy McPartlin will play the part of Beulah. She says there's a key moment in the show for the passengers.
They're sequestered in the airplanes that you actually haven't seen or really heard what's been happening. And when they just see it on the televisions at the first time, and there's a musical moment where they say, "Lead us out of the darkness. Lead us somewhere to safety. Lead us far from disaster. Lead us out of the night.
Lead us out of the darkness."
We're all staring at those images, and we just stand helpless watching them.
Lead us somewhere to safety.
We barely know where we are, but we know it's not.
And for me, that is the quintessential moment of Come From Away, because that's what I feel like Come From Away does, is it leads us out of the darkness.
Lead us out of the night.
But it's been so healing for me, and you can see it in the audience members. You don't know exactly what their stories are, but you know that it has healed part of them and uplifted them and made them feel joy, that maybe they can pass this kind of humanity on to other people, even in the smallest of ways.
At the end of the musical, after 5 days in Gander, the Plain People get ready to fly home. And, well, here's how Beulah tells it.
The day they left, we stood at the bar and sang, "For he's a jolly good fellow, and so long it's been good to know you." There wasn't many dry eyes on that door that day.
And as the story goes, the Plain People and the people of Gander are changed forever by the events of 9/11. Couple final notes about the musical, in case you might want to see it yourself. It has a lot of lighter moments and one-liners about Newfoundlanders, their plaid shirts and comfy shoes, their accent, come on we goes, and their essential ritual for visitors, down one shot of rum and kiss a codfish. No kidding. After tonight's show in Washington, D.C., Come From Away will go from away for a few days, and then back to Broadway on September 21st. Oh, and a film version premieres tonight on Apple Plus. I'm Scott Tong, and you're listening to Here and Now.
We've watched over the last 18 months what a pandemic can do to an economy. Industrial production is out of whack, small business revenue is down, evictions are up, and people aren't spending as much. President Biden says his latest efforts to rein in COVID-19 with a vaccination mandate or testing requirement for companies with more than 100 employees is not only a health imperative, it's vital to help jumpstart our faltering economic recovery. Let's check in with Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, for more. Welcome.
Thanks, Tanya. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, Ali, let's look at where the economy stands right now. There are some very positive signs a few months back, but that has somewhat shifted. What is the recovery compared to where economists and officials had hoped we would be right now?
So the interesting part is we're actually better off than most people thought we would be a year or a year and a half ago, right? We thought it would be 2022 before we saw sort of a full recovery. We've already seen wages going up, which is typical of a tight employment market. Businesses are finding it hard to find employees. We've also seen, unemployment go down to 5%. Now, it was in the threes before the pandemic, but we really thought we'd be well into 2022. The problem is the trajectory. The slope has changed. Things were opening fast. People were spending money. Things were getting back to normal. And the Delta variant has completely changed that around. It's threatened two things. One is people and their spending and being out there. The other thing is it's made it very unclear what parents should do about their kids, because there's this back to school thing where a lot of schools want to reopen, but some schools don't have mask mandates. Some states won't allow them to do so. Parents are concerned and kids under 12 can't get vaccinated. So all of this is affecting consumer psyche right now. The economy is, generally speaking, was moving in the right direction and could be again, but the Delta variant is slowing it down. It's been a substantial hiccup.
How much does this slowdown in recovery differ between places with high and low vaccination rates?
Well, it's interesting because places with low vaccination rates are seeing much more COVID and as a result are feeling harder hit. But they're also the places where there are no lockdowns and there are, generally speaking, no restrictions. So, where you see people pulling back is in dining and entertainment and things like that. But in some of those places, they're not pulling back because they've never pulled back or they're not imposing restrictions. So it's kind of unusual. The map of where COVID is exploding right now is not necessarily the map of where things are slowing down, because it is the states that had lockdowns and mandates early that are in some cases doing it again, places like New York and California. And yet the explosions in COVID are in a lot of other states, in most cases in the South.
There are still large barriers preventing people, though, from coming back to the workforce, childcare, stagnant wages. How much of this slowdown do you attribute to the Delta variant?
I think the issue of childcare and school is a very, very big one, because there are people who are thinking about going back to work after the year that they've had, and they're unsure about what the school situation is going to be because there's so much debate about it. So you may know what your school district is doing, but there's so much debate at the state level and the national level about how to deal with kids and masks and things like that, that I think some parents are holding off as much as they can before returning to work. Now, remember, there are a lot of Americans who've been working from home, and and they're still in the game. This is about people who have been unemployed or, you know, chose to leave their jobs. They're more hesitant than you would expect to get back into the job market right now. We are seeing wages increase as a result, which is interesting because there's been such a long battle about increasing the minimum wage at the federal level. Well, the minimum wage at the federal level is still $7.25, but no employer can find someone to work for that kind of money these days.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something you said about places where we see high unvaccination rates and spending in those areas. There's a drop in spending, though, in areas with high vaccination. How do you think Biden's plan addresses the issues consumers have in those areas? Is it hesitancy to go out and spend or tightening of the belt, you know?
So you'll see the hesitancy tends to be in dining and entertainment in heavily vaccinated parts of the country. A lot of virus-wary Americans, including those who have been vaccinated, who are worried about getting coronavirus that is spread by a large unvaccinated population, even in places like New York, they've pulled back on some of their economic activity, even though infection rates among vaccinated people in highly vaccinated states is very low. Your likelihood of getting vaccinated, getting ill and suffering a substantial illness if you've been vaccinated is low. But places like New York, for instance, or Massachusetts, people are pulling back a little bit. In less vaccinated states, like Texas, for instance, that have experienced a large wave of Delta infections, the rising hospitalization and death rates are not really driving economic activity as much as they did in previous waves. So it's definitely an instance of what's actually happening is not the thing that's driving behavior. It's what people think is happening. So if you live in a place where you just don't believe that this COVID thing is a threat, you're maintaining your economic activity.
So much to talk about, Ali Velshi. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, as always, thank you.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Scott Tong. This is Here and Now.